This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Contraception has made it possible for couples to have an active sex life and remain childless. At the same time, science and technology offer new solutions for couples who want children but can't conceive. Elaine Tyler May studies the history of the family. She's the author of the new book, Barren in the Promised Land, A History of Childlessness and Attitudes Toward It. To find out how women today feel about being childless, she placed author queries in hundreds of newspapers and journals, asking childless people to relate their stories. She has a personal story that relates to the subject. Her father devoted his medical practice to the study and treatment of infertility. He was among the clinical researchers who developed the oral contraceptive.
It was kind of funny. I could remember times when friends from college would come home and visit, and I would very proudly say, you know, my dad was one of the developers of the birth control pill, and they would turn to my father with beaming smiles and say in raptured tones, "Oh, thank you, Dr. Tyler." And my father would just bristle at this because, that wasn't his idea, that he was working on a contraceptive technique for me and my other single friends, but rather this was something he thought of very strongly in terms of family planning and not in terms of enabling single women to engage in non-marital sexual activity. So there was some disjunction there between what he thought about his work and what purposes it was taken. And I think that was probably true for a lot of the people working in reproductive medicine at the time.
Did your father lecture you about the pill? Did he expect you to take it or not take it when you were single?
Oh, there was no question in my household that the pill was not to be taken when we were single. When I married, then we had some talks about birth control from, you know, the medical and health standpoint and what would be most appropriate and safest and that kind of thing. But, oh, no, it was never anything I would have raised with my father about sex outside of marriage.
So your father's work with the pill helped make voluntary childlessness a more plausible choice. And you give an interesting statistic in your new book. In 1990, 25% of all women aged 30 to 45 were childless, compared to only 16% who were childless in 1976. What are some of the things that you think account for that increase in childlessness?
Well, the first thing to remember is that that's a fairly recent increase, and that in fact, if you go back a little bit further, there were higher levels of childlessness prior to World War II. In fact, the highest levels were in the 1930s, just on the eve of World War II. So I think what's happening here is that the rate of childlessness actually dropped in half after World War II at the time of the baby boom, when everybody was either planning to have children or having them or trying to have them. So I think if we look at the baby boom era as a kind of oddity historically, because the pronatalist pressures and the reproductive behavior was so unusual, then we can understand that somehow the increase in childlessness since that time is more toward a normal, for the American population at any rate, more toward a normal level of childlessness within the population, although, of course, it is much easier now for people who are married or sexually active to control their fertility, so the chances of people remaining childless, if they actually want to remain childless, are much higher than they used to be.
Now, for those of us who are part of the baby boom, it's so hard to consider the baby boom period as a blip, an abnormality. It's what I grew up with thinking is, you know, what normal was.
Right. And I think that's one of the problems we actually have today in the current political climate, is that the rhetoric, the political rhetoric that is often tossed around, seems to point to the post-World War II years, particularly the 1950s, and a model of white middle-class nuclear family with X numbers of children as the norm, as the, quote, traditional family. And in fact, there was nothing at all traditional about the post-war family. It was really a bizarre formulation that existed really only once in American history and vanished rather quickly. After 20 years, it was gone.
What was unusual about the post-war nuclear family?
Well, if you want to look just at the demographics, first of all, the marriage age dropped precipitously. People were marrying at a very, very young age. And you often hear that during the 40s and the 50s, the rate of premarital, and that was always the way it was measured, the rate of premarital sexual activity did not increase. But since it was always measured against a marital standard, the question was never asked about teenage pregnancy. Well, teenage pregnancy and teenage sexual behavior went up dramatically during those years, but the fact is those teenagers were married. the marriage age was so low that lots and lots of people were marrying during the teen years and having children, and the birth rate was going up reflecting that. The marriage rate was going up. The divorce rate actually went down because there was a very, very, very strong pressure to remain married once you got married. So you have a huge rush into married life and childbearing that was really very unusual and lasted, as I said, about 20 years, and then it vanished just as quickly as it emerged. And now we're really at more typical levels of marriage age, marriage rate, and childlessness.
My guest is Elaine Tyler May, author of the new book, Barren in the Promised Land. It's about being childless. We're after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Elaine Tyler May. Her new book is A History of Childlessness. I'm interested in the range of reasons you found why many people are remaining childless by choice. You say that it's really more than just access to good contraception.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true. If it were simply a matter of access to good contraception, you would have seen a steady increase in childlessness over time rather than a kind of fluctuation that we've seen over the last 200 years. Women who didn't want children were able to achieve childlessness by making use of whatever was available. And up until the recent decades, that usually meant the contraceptive methods that were around, backed up by abortion, and very frequent use of both of those methods. What I found looking in more recent years, a whole range of reasons. Some people really did talk about not liking children and not wanting any, but those people were really in the minority. Much more common was people who said they really enjoyed children, but they just didn't want any of their own. Some of them were teachers and said, you know, I have children all day long, and when I come home, I would just as soon send them to their parents and have some peace and quiet. Or they would say, you know, I raised 12 younger siblings, and I think I've done my bit for child rearing, and I'm very close to my nieces and nephews, and that's plenty satisfaction for me. And there were all kinds of reasons that people gave.
Did a lot of people feel that they were just too busy with their work to have children?
Yeah, but that wasn't as strong a sentiment as I expected in the letters. I thought more and more people writing in more recent years, especially women, would say, well, you know, I have this job and I want to devote myself to it. More common were the perception and the reality that to combine both was really impossible. Even today, in the era when women are often given the message that you can do it all, that you can have everything, they say, you know, it's just not true, because if I have children, I want to do it not by dropping my kids off at a daycare center, but by really raising them, and I can't do both. I need to work, I want to work, and so I'm just not going to have children. More often, though, they described a lifestyle that they had carved out for themselves that would be disrupted by having children, whether it had to do with travel or leisure time or even consumer spending. One of the interesting things I found was that people in the 1940s and 50s during the baby boom era didn't imagine their children as competing consumers within the family, as actually competing with the parents for the use of the family's money. They really saw family spending as a kind of unified endeavor. We are going to spend money together on the family vacation or on the new appliance or the barbecue or whatever it happened to be. But in more recent years, especially those who wanted to remain childless talked about children as competing consumers. I couldn't stand it, they would write, if I had to buy my kid a $200 Nintendo or a $100 pair of tennis shoes or save for a college education. I wouldn't be able to do the things I want to do, and I want to travel, and I want to have nice things in my house. I had a lot of people write and say things like, I hate Tupperware and Herculean. I want to have white rugs, and I want to be able to drink red wine in my house and not worry about things getting spilled.
Another reason given by men and women is that they felt they had enough difficulty parenting the child within.
Yes. There were a lot of New Agers who wrote to me who felt that way, and I was quite taken by how many people used that phraseology, that they were busy raising themselves, raising the child within themselves, nurturing themselves, and they couldn't imagine trying to do that for another human being.
Do you consider women in their 40s today to be the first generation that truly had a choice about whether or not to have children?
No. No, I think really if we look back to the 19th century, the women then also felt that they had a choice, but the choice was really whether or not to marry. And many of them made the choice not to, and that was the way they decided to remain childless. If a woman in the 19th century married, she was almost certainly going to have children, unless there was some infertility problem on her part or on her husband's part.
But you mean to remain celibate, I think.
Right.
So the choice to remain celibate and the choice to have to not have children, I mean, that's two really different things. I mean, I know there, I realize what the relationship is, but, you know, how many people really want to take a vow of celibacy for their whole adult life?
Well, a lot of people did in the 19th century. Maybe not a lot, but enough to count. The Shaker community, for example, was a large and thriving community for many decades based on total community celibacy. And families joined. Men and women who were married to each other, sometimes with their children, joined. And they had the backing of a very strong community, and they could bring their family life together into the Shaker community and live a celibate life and not risk the dangers of pregnancy and childbirth.
You've become something of a historian of the American family. And I wonder if you think most Americans today make certain assumptions about what families are and what's, you know, quote, normal in family life. And if you think history disproves most of these common assumptions.
Well, I don't think most Americans really do have an idea about what's normal. I think most Americans think that their own situation is normal for them. And they're right. There is really no eternal family life. There is no traditional family, which is a word that gets thrown around. The family has always been in transition. It's always been a changing institution. There's always been tremendous variations of how people live their private lives and arrange their sexual lives and their reproductive selves. And we can't really look back and say there's any particular family form that existed and is now suddenly being shattered. It's just not true.
What are some of the variations that you find earlier on in American history?
Well, for one thing, most children did not live to become adults with the two parents who gave them birth. In the early days, the death rate was so high that most children lost at least one parent during their childhood and were often raised by more than one set of parents. So single parenthood is nothing new, and being raised by non-biological parents is nothing new. And those kinds of arrangements, of course, were very common. We're often told that the divorce rate indicates a much higher rate of family breakdown than ever in the past. But again, if we look at death or desertion or just the fact of families coming apart because one member of the family, usually the father, has to move to find work, we find a lot of disruption in the past that mirrors statistically some of the kinds of phenomena we see today, but they were caused by different things.
Is there a demarcation point where you think it became respectable for a woman or a man to choose to remain childless?
Well, if you're talking about married people, because I think it was certainly a respectable choice in the 19th century to choose to remain childless and not married. And in fact, I think there were times when women and men, but especially women, and there's some evidence of this, would choose to remain childless and people would assume they were infertile. And that was also respectable because
you had no choice.
If there wasn't very effective means of treating infertility, then how could you blame someone if they were childless? It was probably just a problem. I think that it is more acceptable now, but the people who wrote to me still talked about the stigma that attaches to being childless, making that choice, that it may be more acceptable, but it's still not fully acceptable. People are still feeling that somehow people look at them odd, people ask them strange questions about what's wrong with you anyway that you don't want children, or they treat them like they're not full adults or full citizens, like they have something wrong with them if they want to make this choice.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Elaine Tyler May is the author of Barren in the Promised Land. She's a professor of American Studies at the University of Minnesota. This is Fresh Air.